gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes. My heart.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Bill ripped on those hippie traders.
Totally. I was watching PBS last night. Oh, I mean, Survivor! I was watching Survivor!
Dude, those liberals are so stupid.
Totally.
Why do they hate America?
Does this happen to you? Tired of the same old Republican talking points shouted at you all day long by ditto heads and Republicans? Don't know what to do? Now you do, hippie! Listen to the Mojo Wire every other Saturday at 8:25 a.m. when liberal brawlers sound off on the news. This is your rhetorical club for these dark times.
Yeah, dude, I was totally watching Fox News. And wait, what's that liberal doing? Oh my God, they're listening to the Mojo Wire! Run! 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 Run!
The Mojo Wire, brought to you by the Darklink Eclectica here on KUCI 88.9 FM.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're also on iTunes at, I think, under Public Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here today with my co-host, the lovely and brilliant Marie Stone.
Hello.
Who's sitting over there smiling. As usual, the show features authors, editors, poets, literary agents, and anyone and everyone who can talk to the business and craft of writing. Today, our guests are Emily Listfield and Tom Parada. First up is going to be Emily Listfield. She's a former magazine editor-in-chief and author of five novels, including the New York Times notable It Was Gonna Be Like Paris. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, Redbook, Self, Ladies' Home Journal, New York Magazine, Parade, and many others. She lives in New York City with her daughter. Hi, Emily.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Great to have you. Marie and I are very much looking forward to talking to you about Waiting to Surface, published by Atria
yes.
Books. Will you talk a little bit about how this book came to be?
Yes. Waiting to Surface is a novel, but it's based very closely on real events in my life. I was working as an editor at Condé Nast, and I had been married for 10 years to a quite successful sculptor. We had a child, who was almost six. When our marriage hit a rocky period, my husband went down to Florida to visit someone, and a few days after he left, I received a call from a police detective in Florida saying that my husband had essentially vanished off the face of the earth. They believed he had drowned. There was some thought it might have been suicide, but they couldn't find his body. And theories began to pile up. The police then changed their mind and thought he might have run off. The Coast Guard was sure that he drowned because of the tides that night. Private detectives thought he died, but they'd never know how exactly. And in fact, his body was never found, and that's all I ever learned.
Mm. How did you decide to write it as a novel as opposed to as a memoir?
That's a great question. There were a number of reasons. With memoirs, I am one of those people who believes everything has to have happened exactly as you write it. And I didn't want to be hamstrung by what time a phone call came or what day. Also, I'm a novelist at heart. And if a story like this occurs to you, happens to you, you want to be able to shape it. In a way, not being as worried about the exact specifics allowed me to mine more emotional truths and really to open myself up and be honest in a deeply meaningful way, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I was wondering if in the wake of the James Fry debacle, I suppose,
yeah,
if people are more reluctant to enter into the memoir territory because you know maybe you feel like you'll be held accountable for every last detail. I wonder if there's more of a reluctance now to write things as memoirs.
I think that's an interesting question. I was actually almost done with this book when that occurred, so mm-hmm. It didn't play into my thinking. But I do think it will affect many writers, and I do think there's a difference between fiction and memoir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you came up with the idea for the book, how did it go? You had your main premise, I would imagine, and then you had the story to put together. How did you do that? I mean, are you an outliner and a plotter, or are you, did you know where you were headed with the story and you just took off?
I am an outliner. This was very different. I'd published 5 novels before. This was very different in that I knew the ending to this story all along. I had lived it. And I also felt very strongly that it had to have a hopeful ending. And Waiting to Surface follows the first year from the initial phone call to coming to terms with that uncertainty. And I always had the last paragraph of the book written. And it was just a matter of getting there. Because I think one of the messages I wanted to make clear is that we all have to deal with uncertainty in our lives. Mine was a very extreme case, but every time you say goodbye to your husband or wife, every time you send a child out into the world, there are really no guarantees. And the challenge for each of us is to risk love again, which the character in the book does, and treasure what we have despite that uncertainty. So I knew where the book was headed all along.
Hmm. It's interesting because alongside of the main plot line, which is tragic and very heavy, is the main character's career in the magazine industry, which is very funny. There's a lot of this, that there's a lot of humor. Was it difficult for you to write humor into the book in such a heavy subject matter where, you know, you lived through this tragic time, but it's always surrounded by a certain amount of light?
Well, actually, it was a lot of fun to write. I had a ball writing that part for a number of reasons. There have been a lot of books, as you know, written in the magazine world, that take place in the magazine world recently, but almost all of them have been written by disgruntled assistants, mm-hmm. and I had a very different vantage point. I was eventually the editor-in-chief of a magazine, and I think there's a lot of silliness and cattiness and fun, but there's also a lot of wit and incredibly smart people working in that business, and I wanted to give a real insider's look at that, and it was a relief to write that. It was fun, and also I think it reflects many women's lives and men. When something happens in your personal life, you don't always have the luxury of just stopping your professional life. And in Waiting to Surface, the main character, Sarah Larkin, has to balance the two, and it just so happens that her professional life was taking off at the same time her personal life was in tatters. But I don't think that it's that unusual to have happen. and in a way that's a relief.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at this point, Emily, it'd be wonderful for you to read from your, from Waiting to Surface, to give our listeners a little taste of the book.
I would love that. I think I'll read from the first chapter of the book. Todd Larkin has gone to Florida, and Sarah has taken their daughter into day camp. It's a hot August morning in New York City, and she goes into her office, and that's when we'll pick up. It was 11:18 when Sarah picked the telephone up on the second ring. This is Detective Ronald Brook with the Loudoun Beach Police Department. The man spoke with a professional calm tinged with a small-town southern accent. Loudoun Beach, Sarah knew, was in Florida. Before more words could come out of his mouth, she became aware of a keening sound sputtering from her chest. Whatever this man needed to say, she knew that she didn't want to hear it. "When was the last time you spoke with your husband?" the detective asked. "He called from Florida on Sunday, 5 days ago." She had been standing in the kitchen when the phone rang just after 6 p.m. She leaned over the counter, her hands cupped around the receiver so that Eliza, sitting a few feet away, would not hear. "I'm terrible at this," Todd had said. "I don't blame her for being mad at me. I'd be mad at me, too." This was the separation, fatherhood. This was the marsh they found themselves in. A man 1,000 miles away, a child sulking at the dining room table, a husband and wife who could not be together and could not be apart. "She's 6 years old," Sarah replied. "You have to keep plugging away at it." There was, for a moment, only the damage they had done. Detective Brook cleared his throat. Later, Sarah could not remember the precise words he used, only his voice as he laid out the few facts he had before her. "Your husband has not been seen since close to midnight on Sunday. He was staying with a woman, Linda Granger. They had a fight, and he told her he was going to the beach. He was very upset about your separation. He was drinking. He had stopped sleeping. He left behind his keys, wallet, money, ID, cell phone, his return airline ticket, a cigarette lighter, and two drawings. One said lonely head dead. The other said drowned. We believe he may have committed suicide. But," he paused, "there is no trace of him, of his body. There's nothing. He could, in fact, be anywhere at all. He could be holed up in one of 1,000 cheap motels that line that strip of the Atlantic Ocean. He could be wandering in the nearby state park, lost in the illogic of a breakdown. He could have staged the whole thing and taken off to California or Europe. He could be using a false name, a false identity, starting over someplace new. Sometimes men do that, especially at times like this. Miss Granger said he was very smart, certainly capable of it," Detective Brooks said matter-of-factly. A foggy ether invaded Sarah's head as she tried to absorb what he was saying. "We are taught to believe that facts exist, that if we do not find an answer, it is because of an error on our part, a flaw in our reasoning, in our search. We are not taught that there are times when answers simply vanish." A staccato sob broke from Sarah's gut. As she raced out through the maze-like floor, there was a silence, an embarrassed pause, as someone else's life spilled messy and chaotic into the air.
Thank you very much. That was Emily Listfield, reading from Waiting to Surface, published by Atria Books. Emily, I'm curious, in writing a novel based on something that happened, what are the challenges in that? I mean, does it become confusing what you should put in the book and what you shouldn't put in the book, or how, what to take from real life and what to fictionalize around the main story?
Well, I think when you write a book, your first responsibility is to the reader, to make it a good story. And so it's not a diary entry. There's a difference between the two. And writing a novel does involve taking things out and editing. So I was very conscious of that. And one of the things that writing Waiting to Surface as a novel rather than a memoir allowed me to do was to create composite characters, particularly from the magazine world, and to compress certain events. Because, in fact, it's a book about suspense. What happened in this marriage? What happened to this person, his body? And what will happen to Sarah Loughran and her daughter? And so I was very clear that it shouldn't be self-indulgent, that the reader had to want to keep turning the page.
Mm-hmm. You know, knowing the ending and sort of knowing the arc of the story before you started it, were there nonetheless some surprises or things that you learned in the writing of it that that perhaps you didn't know when you started?
Yes, there were, as a matter of fact. I think one of the things I really love about the act of writing is that when you have to put words to an experience or an emotion or even a thought, it makes you really consider a little bit more deeply what exactly it is you're thinking or feeling. And in having to do that this time with such a deeply personal story and go through memories, it made me really examine my own feelings, and it also made me really appreciate all that was good in my husband, all that he'd accomplished in his life, and I think that came out of this writing for me.
Hmm. And the epilogue is that nothing was ever discovered.
Nothing was ever discovered, and as a matter of fact, I just got a death certificate a few months ago. It took 7 years.
Wow.
But the time of death, place of death, and cause of death were listed as unknown on the death certificate.
Hmm. Odd.
It's very odd. You just, you know, you hear about these stories, but you don't think it's going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm. In creating composite characters, could you talk a little about that? Because I know that writers, especially new writers, become worried that they're going to write something that's going to embarrass somebody, or somebody's going to recognize themselves, even though they fictionalized that person. So did you worry about that, or what did you do? Did you take certain precautions?
I didn't worry about it because it's not a mean-spirited book. So especially in the magazine world, there are composites, and it did become a little bit of a guessing game among a certain echelon of the New York Magazine world of who's who. And a lot of people came up to me and said, I'm that person. But they all kind of liked it. I mean, I think I poke some fun at that world, but it's affectionate fun. And again, your responsibility is to the reader, and by creating composites, you can put elements of a number of people into one person.
Mm-hmm. How about, I wanted to talk to you for a few minutes, because we have a little bit of time left, about promotion, because this is something where writers really, I think, fall down. They want to write the book, but they don't really want to have to promote it, or they want the publisher to take care of that part of things. And these days, it doesn't work like that. Publishers do very little, it seems, to get a book out there and to keep it out there. Will you talk about some of the things you've done? Because I found you through some of your promotions on AuthorBuzz.com, actually.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, because I've learned from my own mistakes. I had published novels in the past and done exactly what you say, assume my publisher will take care of it, and of course within a week you're lost in the shuffle. I was determined not to let that happen this time. I also knew from being a magazine editor for many years that it's hard to get attention for fiction, but this was a natural because it was based on a true story. So when I sold the book, I was very lucky that a number of publishers were interested, but they all asked me, would I be willing to talk about the true story? And I assured them that I would, but then I wanted to hear what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think you have to be aggressive. You have to use all your connections. You have to stay on top of your publisher. And I, frankly, also hired an outside publicist because I do want people to read my book.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting what you said about how they want to know if you'll talk about the true story, because I've heard that that radio, TV people really want novelists who have a sort of a story to talk about other than the novel.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I did a segment for the Weekend Today show that is supposed to air this weekend, and there's been a lot of press on the book, and a lot of them, you know, want to see pictures of my husband and me and my daughter, and that's not always the case with novels.
Mm-hmm.
They review it as a novel as well, but there's interest in the true story behind it.
Yeah, I find that sort of, I don't know what I think about that. I know that that novelists are happy to come on this show because they say there's not a whole lot of venues for novelists. They all want nonfiction writers that who actually have a story, and I just find that bizarre because I think there's so much to talk about, even if your story, your novel is totally fictionalized. And
I absolutely agree, and I think, you know, I love writing, and I'm a novelist, and I wish novels in general were part of the national dialogue to a larger degree. But I also think in my case, because it walks that line between memoir and fiction, it was only natural for people to be interested.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the book, in terms of, I'm always interested how authors revise and decide what to keep and what to leave out. Was your manuscript basically the one you started with, or how many revisions did you go through? Or anything you can tell us about the whole process of revision would be interesting, I think.
Sure. I actually prefer revising to writing. I find first drafts just absolutely painful to get down on paper, and you kind of have to shut off the editor within to just free yourself to get it down. My issue with this book all along was because it happened to me, I needed to make sure it made sense to other people. And my agent, who's Suzanne Gluck at William Morris, knew me so well and lived through this with me that when she read it, she actually said to me, you know what, we need a third person to read this because I'm so busy trying to figure out what's true and what's not that I'm not reading it as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So she brought in someone else from William Morris who read it and was fabulous and said, you know, it's working as fiction, and gave me some notes, and I shaped some, and then was very lucky in that I sold it rather quickly, but my editor also had notes, and I think it's great, as long as you trust your editor, to work with someone who's not as familiar with the material, because you get so inside of it that you can't always see what's working, what's not, especially in terms of pacing, I think is something that editors can really help with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful that you have that sort of help, you know.
I mean, yeah, it's a net. I mean, it's absolutely a net beneath you that you should avail yourself of, as long as you trust the person.
Mm-hmm. We are at the end of our time. Could you give our listeners, our novelists out there, any words of advice?
Yeah, I think that inspiration comes on the job. it's a cliche, but it's true. And I think that even if you just work 45 minutes a day, I wrote this book while I had a full-time job. I got up early in the morning to do it, just to stay in touch with the material and not wait until some, you know, light bulb goes off in your head, but just keep plugging away at it is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. That affixing the behind to the chair and keeping it there is a big deal.
It is. It really is. And making it a priority in your life.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on Writers on Writing.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Emily Listfield speaking to us from New York City. When we come back, we should be back here with Tom Perotta, author of The Abstinence Teacher. Please stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. know, little darling, warm one bed in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The Sharp Show, breaking up the airwaves every Monday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. Broadcasting from UC Irvine in Southern California and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here still with Murray Stone.
I'm back from my cold. I'm suffering.
No one would ever know. She escapes quietly into the lobby out of the studio when she has to cough, and no one can ever tell.
My apologies.
Anyway, we are back. We're going to bring on Tom Parada in just a few seconds. In the meantime, though, I want to remind everyone that we do podcast the show at, how to get there. Let's see. The easiest way probably is to go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen, and there at the top of the page, you'll see directions for listening to past shows. And at this point, I think we have a couple hundred maybe. This show will go up in the next week or so that you can listen again or direct your friends to it. It's the wonderful thing about podcasting. The shows are there 24/7 for you to listen to. We're going to bring on Tom Parada, who is the author of 5 previous works of fiction: Bad Haircut, The Wishbones, Election, the New York Times notable book Joe College, and Little Children, which was made as a film and nominated for all sorts of awards. His new book is The Abstinence Teacher, published by St. Martin's Press. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi.
Great to have you on the show. Let's start with hearing from you, hearing about The Abstinence Teacher, and what brought this book about?
I'm having a little trouble with the connection. Did you ask me what the book is about?
Yeah. How it came to be.
Oh, how it came to be? Well, the book is a novel about the American culture war that we've all been living through for probably the past 20 years or so. And I think that around 2004, when George Bush was reelected, it finally kind of sunk into me just how powerful the Christian right had become in this country, and how many people saw themselves as aligned with its agenda. And it struck me that as a novelist, I'd kind of missed this story, that I was living in my bubble here in Massachusetts, and I really decided that I needed to get out and kind of investigate the culture war from both sides. And so the book is about a liberal sex education teacher who finds herself locked in a battle with an activist evangelical church in her town, and basically it's about how her life gets entwined with the life of a man who belongs to that church, who's the coach of her young daughter's soccer team.
You know, I'm curious because the book is told from two points of view, essentially. And I suppose, as it turns out, the two points of view aren't all that diametrically opposed in the end, but throughout the novel they are. And I'm wondering if you have to get yourself in a mindset when you're writing from two opposite sides of the fence. How do you immerse yourself into one mindset over the other when you really do need to switch theological and philosophical sides?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. I will say this, that the book is set up in such a way that early on the two perspectives are very far apart, as you suggest. So there's about 100 pages from the perspective of Ruth Ramsey, who is the sex education teacher, and then there's a break, and there's about 100 pages from the perspective of Tim Mason, who is the evangelical soccer coach. And as the book moves on, that their sections move closer and closer together. I was only writing one at a time, so in that sense, I only had to really immerse myself in the mind of one of these characters at a time. But as the novel got further on and they moved closer together, it was easier because I knew them pretty well at that point.
I found, of all the characters, I think I found the character of Tim the most sympathetic. And I don't know if you, in writing the book, you had any character in mind that you liked the most or that you wanted readers to connect with the most, or where you really stood on the whole issue, which I liked. I liked that you didn't seem to intrude as an author. But I'm curious what you think about that. I mean, were you especially in favor of any particular character in writing this?
Oh, you know, I don't think that it's a matter of being in favor of a particular character, but I do think that Tim kind of stole the show for me as I was writing. I think I knew Ruth right from the beginning, but Tim was a character I had to get to know. And I think for writers, sometimes that turns out to be a more exciting task, to kind of go where you hadn't gone before and to kind of follow a character down a path that is a little bit murky for you at the beginning. So basically, Tim's struggle is a struggle of a guy who has had a hard life and has found that his Christian faith has helped him to get back on his feet, but it also is a really difficult path for him. He's just really struggling with his faith, and that story of a man struggling with his faith turned out to be a really interesting thing to write about. He's a much more dynamic character, I think, than Ruth. Ruth is somebody whose principles are pretty clear to her at the beginning, and they don't change that much. She's shaken by her experiences and humbled a little bit, but I don't think she changes dramatically in the course of the novel. But Tim is a character who's in flux at, you know, almost every moment that we see him. You know, he's constantly trying to keep connected to his faith, but he's tempted away from it. He's just tiptoeing along a certain kind of abyss throughout the whole novel, and it turns out to be a very exciting character for that reason.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and today Marie and I are here with Tom Perotta, author of The Abstinence Teacher.
Did you literally have to go to places you hadn't been before and do a fair amount of research? Did you, you know, attend these church seminars and sort of immerse yourself in that culture for a while?
I did, yeah, and that, you know, I think one of the reasons that I came to like Tim so much is I did have to kind of work pretty hard to enter into his world, because I'm not a religious person myself, and I really was concerned with getting that part of his experience right. So some of it was, you know, involved real reporting, you know, going to church or going to a Promise Keepers rally one weekend. And others of it was much more of a sort of daily immersion thing. I tried to read the Bible every day before I wrote, and I tried to spend a fair amount of time on Christian websites where people were blogging about their faith or offering advice. I just really wanted to get the language of contemporary Christianity into the novel. So there was a fair amount of research for that. But Tim himself is a musician with a drug problem, and I've actually written a fair amount about musicians in the past. And so in a way, I was starting with a familiar character and then following him through a kind of unfamiliar world. And that combination, I think, was really kind of interesting for me. I really could imagine how a guy with this particular experience would wrestle with, you know, contemporary Christian theology.
Yeah, I mean, some of the aspects of it were pretty seductive. I could see where he would, I myself am not religious either, but I can see where he'd be taken in, especially when you're at a weak point like that. So I thought you did a fair amount of justice to the to that camp, even though some of it was, you know, was sort of tongue-in-cheek, and the humor in this was so wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think that exactly this sense of, I think a lot of people are drawn to church partly because of the theology, but I bet more often for just a sense of community in their day-to-day lives, and a sense that, you know, people care about them, that their stories are, you know, really matter in some kind of cosmic sense. Tim is a guy who had screwed up his life. You know, his wife had left him. He had very limited access to his daughter, and, you know, his career had stalled, and he was in, you know, danger of killing himself with drugs. And I think for him to find that within this church, people loved him, cared about him, cared deeply about him, you know, wanted to help him along, I think that was just a really beautiful and powerful thing for him at that point in his life.
Hmm. I think it was around page 165, which seemed to be about the middle of the book or thereabouts. Eliza, Ruth's daughter, declares that she believes in God, which is a really major thing for Ruth. And in terms of structure, to me, that seems sort of like the midpoint of the novel. And I know you are a screenwriter as well, and I was so curious at that point whether you you structure novels in similarly to how you might structure a screenplay, with the plot points and the midpoint and all that sort of thing.
I certainly don't do it consciously, and in fact, I think it's hard to know when you're in the middle of a book whether you're at the midpoint or not. I think that it's possible that in some deep sense I've assimilated some idea of narrative from watching a lot of movies when I was a kid. I do have this sense that I think maybe more than some other novelists of my generation that plot should be fairly tightly constructed, and that the novel doesn't just wander all over the place. I like novels that are really episodic and sprawling, but I'm not able to write them.
So are you a plotter then? I'm always curious. I mean, did you pretty much know what this was going to be, and you had the beginning, the end, and the way to get there, or how did it go for you?
Anything like that. I mean, at most I have a kind of sense of maybe the main question I want the book to answer, or a kind of inciting incident. I mean, I think that when I got started, all I really knew was that this controversy over a prayer at a soccer game was going to generate the plot. But where that was going to go, or the fact that Tim was going to become so central to the novel, all that was something that emerged from the writing process and was a very interesting surprise for me. I really like there to be a kind of element of improvisation and an element of surprise in the process of writing the book.
I know you had studied with Tom Berger and Tobias Wolff as part of your training. Were there what were kind of the big lessons, or what was that experience like for you? What did they impart on you as a writer?
It's interesting. I've been very lucky in the teachers that I had. I think one thing is both Berger and Tobias Wolff are very funny writers, and they're very serious writers at the same time. And I think that that was really a very good thing for me to see at that point in my career, because I have a real inclination toward the comic myself, and it was interesting to realize that you could be a serious writer while also, you know, letting yourself be funny and entertaining. So those two things were very important. I think Berger is a very playful writer, though, a book like Little Big Man, I think, is a real, people don't talk about it so much now, but if you go back and read it, it's an amazing American epic. And so I think he had a desire to kind of talk about American history with this sort of comic epic. Wolf, I think, is just a very, very serious about the morality of everyday life and the moral decisions that ordinary people have to make, sometimes in very obscure situations where no one's even looking. He just seemed to know how to infuse everyday life with moral seriousness, and that's something that I've really taken to heart as a goal for a fiction writer.
Yeah, there are definitely parts of this that were, laugh out loud funny, and but obviously the underpinnings of the novel were definitely serious. Do you feel like your voice carries forward from novel to novel? Was the humor there all the way along, or was that, this also is a very playful novel, was that there from the beginning, or did that emerge over time?
I would say that there's a real thread through my work, even if you go all the way back to Bad Haircut, which is a set of coming-of-age stories that I wrote in my late 20s and early 30s, and they're funny and entertaining and simply written, but they deal with some pretty serious things, and I think that throughout my career, that this mix of the comic and the seriousness has been it has been pretty consistent. I do think that Little Children and the Abstinence Teacher have marked a certain kind of shift in the sense that they're less autobiographical. They're set not in sort of working class New Jersey, where I set a lot of my early work, but in kind of more prosperous suburban landscape. And they deal with adult characters. I think I had focused pretty heavily on teenagers and young adults or unwilling adults in some of the earlier books.
I'm also curious about the title, because I love it. I was drawn to it immediately. It seemed a bit less about what the book was about for me, but it was very catchy. How did the title come about?
It's funny. I think this has to do partly with maybe not planning a book out so far in advance. The first 100 pages of the book really are about how Ruth ended up teaching abstinence. And her response to that, and so I think that very early the book had this kind of identity for me, once you seize upon a title and you like it, you kind of stick with it, and I think it really was a title born out of the first section of the book, and it follows through. I think the book is a lot about sexual choices that people have to make, abstinence being, one of those choices, and a kind of difficult one for. I mean, here's Ruth. She's an abstinence teacher, but she's she's also a liberal, pro-sex, feminist who's had a really difficult love life and sexual history, and so it just seemed to capture a lot about Ruth. I guess with Tim, he's a guy with some drug problems, and he's also trying to abstain. It's not a sexual issue for him. Abstinence, I think, being a kind of very interesting metaphor for all sorts of, doing without in people's lives.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and we're still here with Tom Perotta, author of The Abstinence Teacher. A few more minutes left. Because you're adapting the screenplay, The Abstinence Teacher, And I imagine Little Children as well. You wrote the screenplay?
I did. I co-wrote Little Children with Todd Field, the director.
Okay.
And I'm now writing, until we went on strike a couple days ago, I was working on a script of The Abstinence Teacher, collaborating with Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who directed Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah. Now, how do you do that? I mean, especially being the author of the book, how do you come up with what is in the screenplay and what you leave out? I mean, apparently you have to leave out so much because the screenplay is, less than 120 pages. It's dealing with action. It's dealing with dialogue. Is that a difficult thing as a writer of the novel? Would it be easier if you were just writing the screenplay directly and not going through a book?
Oh, no, I think not. You know, I think the process of, you know, writing the novel and thinking about the characters in the expansive way that a novel allows you to think about characters. For instance, you know, you have lots and lots of information about Tim and Ruth's backgrounds that it would be, you know, hard to fit into a screenplay, but at least I know them mm-hmm. as the writer. So I don't know, you know, I'm sure there are people who can really write original scripts that have a kind of depth of character that the novels do, but I'm not sure that I could do that. I mean, I really prefer to get to know my characters through the novel writing process. And then the question for the adaptation is much more kind of concrete. You know, how do I translate the novel, which is, you know, this autonomous piece of art, you know, into this other form, which has different kinds of limitations and different kind of possibilities. So, but yeah, it's quite possible for people to write interesting original scripts. I don't think I would be able. I think it would probably take a year in any case. You know, to adapt a novel shouldn't take a year mm-hmm. because you know, a lot of the story and the characters are laid out. But I think if you were just starting from scratch, you'd have to spend a lot of time, you know, getting to know those characters one way or the other. So for me, the questions are much more have to do with the craft of the screenplay and you know, what you cut from the novel, how you convey information that is cinematically that otherwise is conveyed through language in the novel. So it's a really interesting puzzle and challenge for to adapt a novel.
Hmm. Do you read your dialogue aloud, or do you read your entire novel aloud as you're revising?
Oh, you know. I don't, but I do incorporate reading aloud into, especially with certain scenes where I'm worried about it. I mean, it's a sure sign, I think, of whether something's working or not. You can tell when you read it out loud. But I don't do it as a sort of regular thing or go from start to finish with it. But I will, when a scene is bothering me, spend a fair amount of time speaking it out loud, and I like things to read very, very cleanly and simply out loud.
Mm, interesting. We're at the end of our time. Any words of wisdom for our listeners?
Any words of wisdom?
Yeah, any words of wisdom in their novel writing pursuits.
Well, I think that for me it was really a matter of. Persisting. I think that, you know, talent is a mysterious thing and, you know, people tend to fixate on it, but I think they maybe underestimate the importance of persistence, of just working and working and working at it until you get to the place where your talent really comes into play. I think, you know, learning the craft is the one thing that we can all work on regardless of our talent, and I think learning the craft helps us to access our talents. You know, rather than vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Does it become easier? Has it become easier for you? You've had success, and is it an easier thing now, or do you always feel like you're starting over?
It's easier in some ways because I think I've having some success and having, you know, knowing that certain readers have enjoyed your work or take mm-hmm. pleasure in it makes you trust your instincts more. So that helps. I think it's really hard when you question every choice you make. So in that sense, I think writing is a simpler thing. I feel like I can trust my judgment. But, you know, I also feel like you have to grow and change and not repeat yourself. And so there's always some element of taking on a challenge that you're not sure you can meet.
Yeah. Well, we very much appreciate your time here and have been fans of your work, so thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
That was Tom Perotta speaking to us from where? The East Coast.
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. His book, his current book is The Abstinence Teacher. Mm. So how are you feeling, Marie?
I'm doing better. I'm concentrating on not coughing most of the morning.
She's sitting over there with her bag of Halls and serious look on her face.
You know, I love that You brought these two books to me, and I typically choose, as we were talking about this morning, I typically choose very heavy, depressing fiction. And so these books, both of them, even though they were dealing with heavy subject matters, they were both did it with humor and with wit and with a lighthearted style, and it was a good diversion for me from my normal.
You know, that's interesting, yeah, because I always respect all of those heavy, dark books. You had Andrea Barrett on last week, the week before?
About a month ago, maybe, yeah.
And Claire Davis, and I respect those writers, and I love what they write about. Well, and Claire, I should keep Claire out of it, because let's just talk about Andrea, who has won a National Book Award or Pulitzer or something
for
her past work. And so respect her. I can't read her stuff because it's so dark. And
it's very heavy.
And
it's
I become more depressed.
I know. So do I. So do I. But I like that.
It's so interesting, you know, just how we're drawn to what we read and what does it. I mean, I love that you want to read these books and talk to these authors, because I always wanted them on the show. I don't want to have to...
Well, there was a fair amount of humor in Claire Davis's short stories. I mean, anybody who, you know, dissects animals on their kitchen table is... that's just funny. that's good stuff.
Yeah.
But both of these authors, and I was surprised by Emily Listfield in particular. I think she really brought, having lived through that experience, I am still sorry she didn't write that as a memoir, because I think hopefully people will know that's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
It really drew me to her book. But I think that the amount of humor and levity that she brought to something so horrific that she lived through was really, you know, maybe a credit to her voice or her style, but it certainly did the book a great service, too.
You know, actually on her book flap, it does say, based on the author's own experiences, waiting to surface, da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wonder how much that's brought out in the promo, because that always makes me want to read a book more. Well, certain novels, if I know that they come from someone's life. But it is curious why certain books are written as novels and not memoir.
Yeah, but I mean, it was more than based on her life. It really sounded like it was really her life.
Mm-hmm.
The magazine portion of it and her daughter and obviously what she went through with her husband was it sounds very autobiographical, and that's, you know, such an amazing, unique experience.
Mm. Yeah, what fun. And Tom Perata, I loved Little Children. And
in
this book I liked quite a lot too. I wanted to talk to him about the ending, and we didn't get to that. But that's probably okay for readers to not have to hear much about
the ending. They don't want to know about the ending.
Yeah. we want to tell you about the ending. You got to read the book.
Yeah, he has got just a great style. I love, there were parts of this book that really were laugh out loud funny.
Yeah. Yeah, his technique is sort of seamless. You don't really see what he's doing. I mean, you're so drawn in, and as writers ourselves, at least I know I'm sort of deconstructing books and stories as I'm reading them to see how they're put together.
Yep.
And I think his, The Abstinence Teacher, I just got caught up and forgot to pay attention.
Yeah.
Except when I hit that page 165 and this thread came in and I went, midpoint! But of course it wasn't, so whatever.
And he'd be a great teacher of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Dialogue's tough for me.
Mm-hmm.
And his characters are, they all sound different, and they all are very authentic, I think.
Mm. Well, anyway, we're at the end of our time once again. And if you want to know more about the show and who's going to be on, you can go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. You'll find the schedule there, and you can also email if you want to be on the weekly email list and see who's going to be on that week. That's all for me. I think you have a quote for us.
Stole a quote from Stephen King, who said, "Fiction is a lie, and good fiction is the truth inside the lie."
That's a good one.
I will be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time.
And who are you going to have?
I am with Michael Quadland, who wrote That Was Then, and
Dinah Lenny.
Dinah Lenny, that's right.
Yeah, she wrote Bigger Than Life.
Bigger Than Life, another heavy memoir.
She's also the nurse on ER.
I read that. Yeah, I read that.
So it's kind of interesting. I met her as a writer, and I went, you're the nurse on ER. I don't watch ER, but that's very interesting.
That is. That is.
Yeah, it's a heavy story. Thanks, Marie.
Thank you. It was fun.
And thank all of you out there, and get back here next week at 9 a.m.
You listen to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. It's time for a little reggae music. What do you think?